Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today, vaccine hesitancy is high in Wyoming and in Natrona County. That has meant a huge surplus in shots.
Well, I firmly believe that I'm immune to it, so I wouldn't bother getting one.
Wyoming State Superintendent Jillian Balow is pushing back on a federal proposal that seeks to include more diverse sources and perspectives in history and civics classes.
I think the larger issue that this symbolizes is maybe a move toward more control over education by the federal government.
And we remember the famous artist, Nelchi.
Yeah, I failed art in the third grade. Now how you do that, I wouldn't stay in the lines.
Join us for Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming is among the states with the highest vaccine hesitancy rates in the country. In Natrona County, that's left the local health department with a surplus of vaccines and empty appointment slots. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports.
It's a Monday in Casper, Wyoming. I'm standing inside what was once a Macy's store and a shopping mall. There's lots of mirrors, the old beauty department counter, and what used to be changing rooms. But now, this is a well-oiled pandemic-fighting machine, but with no customers.
If you just are out doing your thing and think, well, I have a spare 30 minutes, I could go get my vaccine, come on down, we're happy to do it.
That's Haley Bloom with the Casper Natrona County Health Department. When the agency converted this building into a COVID-19 vaccine clinic, they estimated it would be capable of vaccinating up to 1,500 people a day.
We've never had more than probably 800 to 900. A typical day has been around 200 to 400.
Demand has slowed down. So much so, the department had to ask the state to halt their vaccine shipments earlier in April because they were sitting on a surplus of 20,000 shots. Nonetheless, Bloom seems optimistic, or at least playing it cool in order to create the kind of environment where people can be honest about their vaccine fears.
So if someone comes and they're unsure, they have questions, we're happy to chat with them, send a nurse over to chat with them, whatever it takes. And, you know, if it's not the right time, no one says that you can't walk out and think about it some more and come back next week.
Mark Dowell admits it's difficult to stay cool.
It makes you very frustrated. You try not to get mad.
Dowell is the Natrona County Health Officer and an infectious disease expert. He says it's also difficult dealing with the amount of misinformation that's discouraging people from getting the shot.
You try to stay even keel so you can serve the people that have put you in the position.
More than 32% of the population in Natrona County are thought to be vaccine hesitant, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. That's one of the highest percentages in the country. Take Connie Anthony, for example. I spoke to her outside the public library in Casper.
I choose not to get vaccinated. I just don't have that much trust in government vaccines and such. I don't want anything injected into my body that just hasn't been thoroughly researched, and so no.
All vaccines go through clinical trials to test safety and effectiveness. And long-term side effects after any vaccination are extremely rare. But that's not what worries someone like Dale Godleys. There's been just 33 new cases in Natrona County over the past 2 weeks, so he doesn't think getting vaccinated is necessary.
Well, I firmly believe that I'm immune to it, so I wouldn't bother getting one.
When it comes to vaccine hesitancy, politics may be playing a part here in Natrona County, which voted overwhelmingly to re-elect former President Donald Trump. But the health department is mostly encountering people with concerns about safety and side effects. That was the case for Casper resident Brittany Braddis. I spoke to her on the phone.
I didn't want to get the shot because I didn't want to get sick, because all these people I hear are just getting so sick.
At the same time, Braddis has been really worried about getting the virus. She has severe asthma, plus she deals with the public since she and her husband own a butcher shop together. And like so many, she turned to social media to get more information. She wanted to hear from the people she already knows, so she posted on Facebook.
I just wanted to know what friends of mine have gotten the shot and what happened to them. Like, how many people got sick? How many people didn't? You know what I mean?
she got 135 responses, and they ran the gamut. Some people really discouraged Bratis from getting the vaccine, while others reassured her that it was the right choice to make.
But then people getting in fights with each other, it's so dumb.
Ultimately, the vaccine won out, partly because of what her friends working in healthcare told her, but also it was simply convenient. When she took her mom to the health department to get vaccinated, she asked the nurse if she could get one too.
So I just did it, and guess what? I got Pfizer, and I was completely fine with both shots.
Bratis's experience reflects what many public health experts are saying about this point in the vaccine rollout. Most of those in our region that were willing or eager to get vaccinated have done so. It's now down to the folks that are on the fence. Shonda Schrader is a rural health expert. She says people that are hesitant don't want to hear from the government or even scientists.
They want to hear from someone they trust. They need to know that it's safe and effective, and they need to be able to ask those questions in a safe space.
Schrader says those one-on-one conversations will be critical for helping people make informed decisions. And when they do decide they're ready, she says a shot also needs to be at the ready. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
A Casper-based nonprofit called Art 321 is holding its first statewide conference aimed at addressing the health concerns of Wyoming residents through the arts. Wyoming has the highest youth incarceration rate and one of the highest suicide rates in the nation. But the Casper-based nonprofit Art 321 plans to fight against it using the arts. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rouse speaks with the nonprofit's executive director, Tyler Sesser, about the need for a conference like this.
Everything that was a concern before the pandemic is only exacerbated now, right? So this is the first statewide effort to bring together a coalition of artists, healthcare providers, community service providers, you know, anyone that is interested in improving the health outcomes of Wyoming residents through the arts. It came about. Both Hillary Camino and I, who is a board-certified music therapist out of Jackson, started this several years ago at a very kind of grassroots level. And then Art 321 had an established history of creating programs or creating guiding documents and resources for programs like the Healing Through Art Toolkit that they created a number of years ago based on an increase in youth suicide rates in Casper. So building on that tradition, the work Hillary and I have done, that's what created this conference for us. You know, we thought about maybe postponing it to next year, just because, you know, everything with COVID, planning was hard, logistics are hard, but we decided that it was too kind of timely and critical for us to not do something. So this year, we decided to really prioritize just bringing together a coalition of leaders and artists in whatever ways that they could attend. So that's why this conference is, you can attend either online or in person. It's fully hybrid so that people could attend in the ways that are most comfortable to them.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about, because you mentioned that now is sort of the most timely time, if that's even a word, the most timely time to hold this event. What inspired to create or start this conference?
Initially, Hillary and I had looked at the lack of direct support for clinical music therapy in the state. About 16 other states have music therapy covered in some way under their state Medicaid programs, either through waiver or through statute. That's what started this journey several years ago. But then as we kind of invested more in this arts and health program, we saw this continuum of arts and health from, you know, communities that just have vibrant arts-infused, culturally relevant activities going on. They are, you know, have a tendency to be healthier. There's greater social cohesion, interaction. And then we saw on the other side of that continuum, right, is the direct interventions like clinical music therapy. So that, you know, kind of continuum is then what led, I have been serving on the State Health Improvement Plan Steering Committee for the Department of Health. And just sitting in that room, hearing the assessment, the findings, and the kind of great needs of residents in Wyoming, I wanted to figure out, like, how do we get the creative community involved in solving these health challenges, you know, and just partnering with healthcare providers, partnering with these community service leaders, and also finding ways to just showcase the power of arts as an inherently healthy activity. And that's, I guess, the genesis of this, right, was just trying to bring people together to identify in resource arts and health programs.
You know, while we're talking about health, we're still in the middle of a pandemic. And why do you think it's especially important to hold this conference program right now while COVID-19 is still going on? Because I know we mentioned that it's extremely important and very timely to have this conference right now, but why? Why COVID-19 made it important to have it now?
If you had feelings of isolation and lack of community cohesion, that's exactly what we made worse, you know, or what was made worse during COVID. And now is a time for us to say, okay, what can we do today, tomorrow, next year? And we didn't want to push that conversation off to next year. We like, for example, Lindsay Hughes, our keynote speaker from the Department of Health, you know, she's very concerned, as we are, about what's the fallout going to be for healthcare providers or those that are on, you know, boots on the ground dealing with COVID every day, you know, just the full extent of their capacity. What is that going to look like when they finally get to rest and sit down and process their own grief and their own emotions? And how do we preventatively support them through that experience, right? I don't want to see a rise in provider burnout or provider suicide, you know, heaven forbid. We want to get ahead of that. And this conference was one small step for us to say, like, let's rally the troops, let's get people involved and figure out some action that we can take in our own communities. Next year, we'll have the next conference and we'll dig a little deeper and move a little further forward. But this year, it's all about bringing the community coalition together.
Yeah. What do you hope the community and participants and attendees take away from this whole conference program?
I hope they take away some, you know, energy and excitement for what is possible through the arts. They also know that they, as an individual, can influence the health of anyone around them, either directly or even just passively through, you know, your art as a way to express complex narratives and emotions that might help someone else feel like they're not alone, or it might share an experience with somebody. And even just getting together with a couple friends to create together is also inherently healthy and can be part of that healing process for folks. So I guess the takeaway for me is, like, anyone at any time, anywhere can create arts programs that improve health with the right resources and investment.
Executive Director of Art 321, Tyler Sesser, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
The conference is scheduled for May 20th through the 22nd in Casper. And if you or someone you know may be considering suicide, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or the Crisis Text Line by texting HOME to 741-741. In a moment, tribal leaders across our region say last year's CARES Act funding came with a tight deadline and no clear spending guidelines. They hope the Biden administration will solve that problem with new aid for the tribes. That's coming up next on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
This time on Carbon Valley. One community is wrestling with the potential early closure of their coal plant.
And I think maybe we should have been talking about this 5 years ago. I think it's out of sight, out of mind thing.
How carbon capture ever became a solution for coal's decline. I'm Cooper McKim. Find Carbon Valley under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. The latest coronavirus relief package includes $20 billion for tribal governments, a potentially transformative infusion of cash. But last year's aid rollout to Indian country was badly mismanaged, and tribal leaders hope the Biden administration has learned from those mistakes. The Mountain West News Bureau's Savannah Marr reports.
Tribal governments are used to stretching every dollar that comes their way. But last year, many faced a different challenge.
The money came at us quick and it was a flurry.
We were spending money like crazy.
And it's sad because what that turns into is wasteful government spending.
Those are the voices of a few tribal leaders and administrators from throughout our region. Millions in CARES Act dollars started to arrive in their tribal coffers in May of 2020. Weeks after it was promised.
It was overwhelming and it was daunting because it's like, are we going to be able to pull this off?
Karen Snyder coordinates pandemic response for the Eastern Shoshone Tribe in Wyoming. She says that delay, combined with a December 30th spending deadline, gave the tribe just 6 months to spend $14 million, more than it typically spends in a year.
I just don't think that deadline was ever realistic, nor was it conducive to us doing good planning.
The Eastern Shoshone Tribe ended up doling out millions in direct payments to tribal citizens. Snyder says that assistance was badly needed, but that given an extended deadline, the tribe would have spent more on long overdue infrastructure improvements.
I don't want to use the word responsible or irresponsible spending, but boy, sometimes that's kind of the category you have to put yourself in.
In Montana, the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa did attempt a big infrastructure project, construction on a new health clinic. But Chairman Gerald Gray says finishing before the end of the year was out of the question.
By the time we found a piece of property and started the engineering process and the architects, we wouldn't have time.
So the tribe had to pre-purchase materials, equipment, and labor contracts.
Come December 29th, I'm going to be buying the $500 hammer, not the $5 one.
But then, just before the end of the year, Congress extended the deadline to the end of 2021. Snyder of the Eastern Shoshone Tribe was annoyed.
Very counterproductive. For them to wait till the final hour, I mean, to us out in Indian country that we're sweating bullets. But in light of the administration, it doesn't really surprise me.
The deadline flip-flop was just one move by the Trump administration that frustrated tribal leaders during last year's CARES Act rollout. Eric Henson researches American Indian economic development at Harvard. In some ways, he says the Biden administration has already learned from and improved upon last year's process. For one, tribal governments will have until the end of 2024 to spend the money headed their way from the American Rescue Plan.
I mean, you can argue that maybe it should be longer still, but, you know, having a 2.5 years instead of like 6 months.
Henson says that will allow tribes to tackle some of the fundamental infrastructure deficiencies that made their communities so vulnerable to COVID-19 in the first place.
Step back and take advantage of the ability to do some planning. To make the kinds of investments that really will like help you build the infrastructure that can prop you up going forward.
As of now, though, the plan narrows infrastructure spending for tribes to water, sewer, and broadband. And Henson says tribal needs are so interwoven and so vast that it's not possible to address just those few pieces of infrastructure.
Hey, we're going to invest some of these dollars in our water infrastructure, but we need to greatly enhance the electrification around it all to make sure the water and sewer works. Is that okay?
During last year's CARES Act rollout, Henson says those sorts of questions went unanswered, and it's not yet clear what kind of support will be available this time around.
Treasury should have a team of people in place who are equipped to field an inquiry like that pretty quickly.
And tribal leaders have another big question: how the $20 billion will be divided up between them. Last year's allocation formula relied on outdated and incomplete federal data about each tribe's total enrollment, resulting in some tribes being overcompensated and others being shorted millions. The Mescalero Apache tribe in southern New Mexico was on the losing end.
We're sitting about 5,300 tribal members, but we only got funding for like 3,500.
President Gabe Aguilar says this was especially frustrating because tribes were asked to report their own citizenship numbers, and the feds used the flawed data anyway.
That's pretty much saying, we just wanted a little input, but we're going to do this anyways. You know, we already had our mind made up.
Aguilar is optimistic that this year's rollout will go more smoothly, and that the unprecedented amount of aid will make a lasting difference in Indian country. Treasury has until May 10th to start dispersing the money. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Savannah Marr.
A new exhibit at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West focuses on Black cowboys and rodeos. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska speaks with photographer Ivan McClellan about his work and the first black rodeo he went to in Oklahoma.
Got out of my car and saw 2,000 black cowboys there, and I was just enamored of the culture immediately. The way that people dressed, the way that, you know, people wore braids, people had long acrylic nails, there was hip-hop music playing. Like, it just completely shattered my conceptions of, like, what a rodeo was and really expanded my idea of, like, what black people can be. So I just got really fascinated with documenting that culture and kept going to rodeos over and over and over again for the next, you know, few years.
Wow. And had you ever been to a rodeo before that?
Yeah, I grew up in Kansas, so we would go to the American Royal. I remember it very well as a kid going there, but we never went to black rodeos.
Right. So this was like a completely different aspect and side and culture of it.
I grew up around black men that farmed, black men that raised cattle, but I never called him a cowboy. Because he was black. And I was like, black people aren't cowboys. I just kind of had that idea in my head. And it wasn't until I went to this rodeo and I saw people roping and wrestling steers and riding bulls and wearing Stetsons and all of that stuff. But they were all black, that I was like, it's undeniable. These are cowboys. They're real. You know, I just had to kind of accept that in my mind.
It sounds like for you at one point, cowboy meant something different.
The only black cowboys that I ever saw was like Cowboy Curtis on Pee-wee's Playhouse or Blazing Saddles. You know, I'd seen cowboys that were more like a joke, you know. I saw like Sinbad and the Cherokee Kid. And I just thought that the only real cowboys are white, you know, like they look like John Wayne. They wear chaps. They wear spurs. They live in a place like Wyoming on big plains and big ranches. And just like coming to realize that black cowboys were a lot more accessible as an adult, you know, realize that like you could be a black cowboy and live in the middle of Philadelphia. You know, they live in big cities. They rodeo, you know, they ride trucks. They do a lot of the things that you expect a cowboy to, but a lot of the stereotypes are kind of broken, and you see, you know, guys riding horses in Jordans, and you see guys riding horses in basketball shorts with no shirt on and gold chains and earrings. And, you know, they look like a figure that you would expect to see in a rap video or you expect to see out of hip hop culture. But they're absolutely cowboys. They actually they raise horses. They live on farms. And so really kind of shattered a lot of my own conceptions and really forced me to kind of mature my thought process there.
Is there a, I don't know, specific picture or a specific moment that kind of, when you've been at one of these rodeos, that kind of exemplifies to you, like, why this matters?
One of my favorite ones is, I call it Three Kings, and I got the guy's names after I took the photo. They actually found me on Instagram, and they were like, that's me. And I was like, what's your name? And he's like, Napoleon. And I was like, of course your name's Napoleon. Like, look at you. It's three black horsemen, three young men riding their horses, and they just look so cool. One of them has a towel around his neck, and he's just looking straight at the camera. The other one's looking to the side. He's just being really cool. But if you zoom into the photo, if you look at it really closely, the guy in the middle has an earring in his ear. He's got a diamond stud earring. And it's like, I didn't notice it for years. And when I finally noticed it, I was like, that. Because otherwise, they're in complete Western wear. Huh. They're in starched shirts. They're in jeans. They're riding their horses. They're wearing Stetsons. But that earring is the only thing that has any sense of like modernity. It's the thing that gives it away, that this is something contemporary and this is something different than what you would expect out of a normal cowboy. That photo, I don't know, I just keep coming back to it. It was like one of the very first ones that I did back in 2015. And I've took tens of thousands of photos since then. And that one still like resonates to me and really represents the show.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier when you were talking about the Three Kings, that it's kind of showing the modernity of the cowboys. And it made me think, like, you know, we're sitting in Cody, Wyoming, and the whole image of this town really is the Old West. And I wonder what it means to you to have your photos displayed in a place where it's all about that white cowboy, that like old image that we all see, that iconic image of the cowboy.
Yeah, I love that image. You know, like I said, I grew up with it. I don't at all want to change that image. I don't want to do anything to replace it. I just want to add to it. you know? And it's like, yes, Buffalo Bill. And, you know, if you want to keep it in the past, there's really cool guys. There's Bass Reeves, there's Bill Pickett. But my work focuses on what's going on right now.
Right.
And I want people to know that, like, rodeos aren't just a celebration of the past. They're about what's going on right now. The first time that I heard Lil Nas X's Old Town Road was at a rodeo. And that's because at Black rodeos, they play hip hop. They play the most current music. And you actually go there and learn about, you know, Lil Nas X, and you learn about Breland, and you learn about these guys that are doing, like, this merger of hip hop and country and into one culture. And it's about, like, current fashion, and it's about, like, slang and stuff that people say, and it's about the youth, and, you know, all of that energy and all of that modernity, I think, refreshes rodeo and makes it something really current and really relevant to our time right now.
And what do you hope, you know, visitors to the museum will get out of your exhibit?
I also hope that people that don't know anything about this culture get curious about it and dive deeper into it and ask questions about their own perceptions and say, wow, what did I not know about rodeo? You know, what did I not know about cowboys? I need to do some research. I need to learn. You know, I think it's important to not only be curious about Black rodeos, but be curious about Native American rodeos, to be curious about, you know, the whole Mexican cowboy tradition. All of these things, like, really form the American West, and all of these folks made a major contribution to the West. So as we tell stories and as we research that identity of the American cowboy, let's like try to expand it and be more inclusive.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Really appreciate your time.
That was Camila Kudelska speaking with photographer Ian McClellan on his new exhibit at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West. When we come back, our congressional delegation weighs in on the president's infrastructure package, and State Superintendent Jillian Bailo joins us to express her concern over a federal plan to include diverse perspectives in history and civics. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, Greg and his best friend Rob dreamed of a huge Alaskan backcountry adventure together, but a wild river got in the way.
So my mantra when I am on the trail is keep walking, don't die.
Reaching Rob's Roadhouse. I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Some Democrats are prepared to go around Republicans to pass President Joe Biden's more than $2 trillion infrastructure proposal. That's not sitting well with Wyoming's congressional delegation. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
Back in March, Democrats passed a whopping $1.9 trillion pandemic relief bill, which included the stimulus checks and more benefits for the unemployed. Less than a month later, President Biden unveiled a roughly $2.3 trillion infrastructure bill. Wyoming Senior Senator John Barrasso says it's fiscal insanity.
So when I look at all of this spending in the $2 trillion plan, I'll tell you, this isn't monopoly money. It's real money. You just don't get to pass go and get another $2 trillion to spend.
Democrats are quick to point out what they call GOP hypocrisy from party leaders like Barrasso, who's the number three Republican leader in the Senate. That's because under the last administration, the GOP dropped trillions of dollars on tax cuts. But with the International Monetary Fund estimating the economy will witness more than 6% growth this year, and with millions of Americans still out of work or underemployed, President Biden says now is no time to let up on the gas, as he told the nation in his first address to Congress.
America's moving forward, but we can't stop now. We're in competition with China and other countries to win the 21st century.
That's where Biden and congressional Democrats are trying to use this recession to rebuild America in their party's own image, an image they say will make Americans healthier and wealthier.
We have to do more than just build back better. We have to build back better. We have to compete more strenuously than we have.
Besides Biden wanting to do things like lay broadband in rural areas and eradicate all lead pipes in the nation, the president also wants to provide average workers with paid sick leave while also providing child care tax credits. Barrasso doesn't like the sound of that one bit.
But we need core infrastructure, the things that people in Wyoming think of as infrastructure, roads, bridges, you know, airports, water systems, things that people in Wyoming really care about and we need to take care of.
Barrasso chaired the Environment and Public Works Committee until Democrats won the majority in the Senate. In the last Congress, he ushered through a bill aimed at improving the nation's physical infrastructure. While Biden is calling for more than $2 trillion, Barrasso's highway bill was only for around $300 billion. He notes that it had bipartisan support.
I voted for it, and Bernie Sanders voted for it. It was the highway bill, roads, bridges, highways, important things that matter for the country. So if we have that kind of bipartisan agreement in the Senate, we should then use that as the core to build upon it.
But there's little appetite for bipartisanship in Washington these days. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says he wants a bipartisan measure, but that if Republicans don't get behind Biden, then he's prepared to go it alone.
We believe a bill has to have strong climate provisions. We believe that the tax code and some of the inequities that the Trump tax cut caused have to be changed. So we will look for bipartisanship wherever we can, but the number one goal is a big, bold plan along the lines of what President Biden has proposed.
More moderate Democrats are balking at the price tag, while progressives, like New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, says it's not nearly enough because she wants to use the package to force Americans off of fossil fuels. A couple weeks back, Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney was on Face the Nation to discuss the sweeping proposal.
This is a pattern that we watch the Democrats use time and again, where they massively increase spending, they massively expand the size and scope of the federal government, and then they come back around and impose middle-class tax increases. So those are not things that we support, not things that I support.
Like Barrasso, Cheney supported Trump's trillions of dollars in tax cuts, though now she's singing a new tune.
I'm really concerned about the impact on the economy, the potential inflationary pressure that we might see with this additional injection of cash, and so much of it is unnecessary.
Barrasso is now the top Republican on the Senate Energy Committee. From that perch, he's trying to convince Energy State Democrats to join him and reduce Biden's proposal.
We are working together and have made a Republican proposal to the White House that really focuses on that core, that hard infrastructure, leaving out all of the other things like the Green New Deal and things like these cafeteria trays that are supposed to be recyclable in the future and so-called climate justice. If we leave that behind, I think we can actually get an agreement with the White House.
Though it remains unclear if that small of a proposal is something Barrasso can get this new president to agree to. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The U.S. Department of Education is proposing a new set of priorities that would incentivize changes to the way history and civics is taught. The federal government is encouraging K-12 schools to include diverse perspectives in history and civics and to take notice of systemic racism in America's history. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler spoke with State Superintendent Jillian Balow about the proposal, which Balow sharply criticized.
What caught my attention and what made this new and frankly alarming to me was the inclusion of specific recommendations for curriculum You know, and that represents two things. Number one, it represents an overreach by the federal government. That's not something that typically the federal government has done. And when they have, it's been concerning for state and local leaders where education decisions should reside. The second thing is that the references, the curricular references that were cited are fairly controversial and have been viewed as divisive. So I have some concerns about that as well.
From what I understand, the proposed priorities aren't going to be like a mandate or anything like that, but instead incentives for grants or programs. Is that correct?
Right. So this is not something that is, you know, at this point and through this proposed rule is not something that schools are forced to do or forced to adopt. It is an opt-in and it's a small grant program. I think the larger issue that this symbolizes is maybe a move toward more control over education by the federal government through, you know, suggesting or maybe down the road mandating curriculum.
And so you also mentioned some concerns about the content of things cited in these proposed priorities, like the 1619 Project and the writings of the scholar Ibram X. Kendi. And so I'm wondering, in your opinion, what are the controversial or divisive components of those works?
I want to just be really clear at the outset that, you know, and I said this in the statement that America, including Wyoming, needs to update and renew our expectations for how teachers teach and students learn about history and civics. Those decisions should be made at the local level, at the state level, and everyone should be working to build a consensus on what should be taught. We look in education for resources and materials that are evidence-based, that are research-based, that have been replicated. That is not the case with the 1619 projects. And that's not to say that there, you know, that there is not merit in teaching the significance of 1619 and the impacts that it has on us as a country. But it distorts some of the facts, frankly, and places a central theme that race and not class is at the forefront of American history.
And I think something that might be a good example of this in Wyoming is the Indian Education for All standards that were passed by the state, because I think it comes along with that same intent of understanding the history and contributions of Indigenous people in this country. And I feel like that intent is pretty on par with what's being asked in these proposed priorities. Do you agree here?
I agree. And guess where those decisions were made? They were made in our communities, in our school districts. Our legislature weighed in. We had a public conversation about this at the state level. There was never a federal government suggestion, mandate, encouragement rule that attached money to it saying, this is what you should focus on as a state when you teach Indian Education for All. That was a grassroots movement from our tribes. And I wholeheartedly support that every Wyoming student needs to understand the past, present, and future impacts of our tribes on our state and on our nation, politically, culturally, monetarily, geographically, etc. The same is true for our Black Americans who reside and have lived in Wyoming. It's important for every single Wyoming student to learn about the diversity that has existed in our state in the past, present, and will continue to exist, the impacts that has had, and then on a larger scale to really understand how we as a nation have been impacted by race and diversity. But as a state, we determine how to teach that, and I completely agree that it needs to be done with greater depth and breadth than it has been in the past. But the federal government is overstepping with even the suggestion in a rule and the monetization of a specific resource.
And so while you say that state and local governments should have the primary control over what is being taught and how in schools, do you not think, though, that there should be some consistency across this country on the foundational things that we learn, especially in history and civics, so that we're all working from the same place?
we do have that in reading, writing, math, and science, and that's in the form of our federal accountability system, and that must be aligned with our state accountability system. We see that play out in our assessments, where we compare ourselves to other states, we compare our students from district to district, even class to class, and even students from one year to the next. So we have sort of those big mile markers for our students that that have sort of that federal outline or that federal framework. We don't have that body or those cues around American history and civics education. And therein lies the issue and the need for the conversation. However, that should not be driven by a proposed rule by the federal government. There are a lot of really great groups that are working on this right now. Those are the most important conversations that we can be having right now, determining what our common ground is and focusing on that as a starting point for the conversations.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler speaking with Wyoming State Superintendent Jillian Balow. When we come back, we will bring you an interview with Wyoming artist Nelji, who died last week. This is Open Spaces.
This time, on The Modern West, our roundtable conversation about solutions to the problem of rural decline.
No, we're not going to wait. This is vital to us. So they make the effort. They collaborate. They get partners. They built it themselves.
Reversing ghost towning, a special bonus episode with rural advocates and thinkers from across the U.S. Find The Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. The celebrated Wyoming artist Nelji died last week at the age of 86. Nelji was also a businesswoman and a philanthropist who contributed a lot to Sheridan County and Wyoming. In 2016, she released her memoir, North of Crazy, that chronicles her journey from high society to the high plains. As the daughter of famed publisher Nelson Doubleday, Nelji had a privileged upbringing, growing up in her family's homes in New York, Long Island, and South Carolina. Then she came to Wyoming. She spoke with Micah Schweitzer in a national award-winning interview, and here's an excerpt.
I mean, reading your book, it's like reading some sort of period drama, right?
This
is the kind of thing I watch on PBS.
Yeah, a little bit. It's a mini Downton Abbey.
Exactly. You read this, and it sounds like The Charmed Life, and yet it seems like perhaps it was not entirely the charmed life.
For me, it wasn't a charmed life. I was lucky to live in a house where there was big rooms, a swimming pool, tennis court. There were all the attributes of wealth, but there was not a wealth of love. That was a vacuum.
This seems like the classic anecdote any successful artist can tell is that, of course, at some point in your early life, you're told that that's not who you are. You failed art in third grade.
Yeah, I failed art in the third grade. Now, how you do that, I wouldn't stay in the lines. I didn't make clear colors. And part of that was simply being too nervous, too scared. I was molested when I was 9, and nobody talked about it. It just sort of disappeared. I was sent to a psychiatrist for a short time and then nothing. And as you hear now, because there's something like over 75% of women have been sexually abused in some form. So I'm not unique by any means. But it takes a long time to get over, and you don't get over it all, ever. When you're 9 years old and the man threatens to kill you if you tell anybody, it's the voice is there. I also had been given hormones so that I would stop growing because I was 5'9" at 9 years old. And those hormones made me a woman. They were trying to get me to have a period at a point when I was much too young.
And this was what, so you wouldn't be too tall?
Yeah, because my father didn't want me to be 6 foot tall. That's what I was told. And he didn't want anybody, he didn't want a woman on equal footing. In any way. Height, mind, looks. He was an old-fashioned man.
But that was also the world you grew up in. I mean, as you point out in the book, it was a, in every way, a male-dominated world.
Absolutely. I've noticed it still is.
Nelci got married when she was 18. Less than 10 years later, she was divorced. And she moved to Wyoming in 1966, where she took an art class at Sheridan College.
The Japanese sumi.
This is an ink technique, right?
Yes, the ink on rice paper. And I learned to do all the classic things, how to make bamboo, how to do plum, how to do bamboo leaf. And I didn't want any of it, but I could do what I wanted to do. I could take what my feeling was from my gut inside and I could lay it down. And I learned that the stroke, the mark you make on a piece of paper is the mark you make in life. It doesn't disappear. You can put another one down over it, but the first one is always there. And that was a philosophical lesson that was, to me, vitally important. And that has been the foundation of all my paintings. Everything is the mark comes from there, right in the solar plexus. And people say to me, well, do you think of something before you paint? Do you have an image in mind? Do you have a subject in mind? And I don't. A good deal of the time, I don't. And you have to be willing to make a terrible mess. And I've made a lot of those. But that's the way it is. That's the way you work. I'm an abstract expressionist, and I paint the moment. I live in the moment.
And in some sense, what you're doing in your large-scale works harkens back to not wanting to draw the bamboo or the bamboo leaf, or even before that, in third grade, not being able to draw within the lines.
No, exactly. Ain't staying there. Not happening.
It does seem that a certain amount of your work does fall within two broad categories. You have what could be considered landscapes.
Yep.
And then also about women.
Well, they're my two subjects. That's all I know anything about. All the rest is conjecture.
When it comes to painting about women, that's about you and about the world that you live in,
that's
about
the
relationship.
That's the way women are treated. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's really about the way women are treated. And for so long, we couldn't say anything. And the anger that I had and still have at the way women are treated and the condescending nature that many men address women, particularly Donald Trump, I find to be insufferable. You can't get anybody to hear you. And I think that's like being imprisoned.
And those are those black bars that are on a lot of your women paintings.
Yeah. Well, the black bars and the one that are on the side of those are what entraps you. Yes, exactly. You read them right.
And you started painting when you were 30.
Yeah.
This is after your divorce, after your nervous breakdown following your divorce. What drove you to paint?
I wanted a voice for my anger. I wanted to be able to speak, and I couldn't. And once I got free with the sumi and I could make the marks of energy and of love and of joy and of delight and of curiosity and of dynamic electricity attached to nothing, I could speak. I had a voice. And I remember the feeling of when I got that voice. It was overwhelming. It flooded right through me to the ends of my fingertips, to my toes, to the end of my nose, to my earlobe, everywhere. And I had nobody I could tell it to. And so I just went out and screamed.
Literally.
Yes, I just went out in the yard and screamed. Yeah.
And if the size of one's painting is maybe indicative of volume, your voice has gotten loud. You're doing 10 by 30 foot paintings now.
They're very comfortable for me. They're about my size because I use my whole body when I paint, and it's like a dance. And once I get rolling, it takes over. I find 4 foot by 4 foot canvases small. Hmm. Now, well, the first canvas I had was maybe 3 inches by 2 inches. And I was too shy to even look up and look at it on the wall of a gallery.
3 inches by 2 inches.
Yes.
So what changed between 3 inches by 2 inches and 10 feet by 30 feet?
I learned, and I did a lot of interior work. I realized I had so much pain and anger and frustration from being ignored as a child and feeling unloved and feeling abandoned, that I had to take care of that in order to grow up. I couldn't just pretend anymore. And the pains that were inside me had to be dealt with. That takes time.
And that's what freed you up to grow artistically.
And that you have to do that in order to be. In order to be, that's what you need to do.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. An archive of the entire program is available at wyomingpublicmedia.org or via the Open Spaces podcast. Individual segments can be found on that website or on our Open Spaces Facebook page. Anna Rader is our digital editor. Congratulations to Wyoming Public Radio reporters Cooper McKim and Taylor Stagner, along with former reporter Savannah Marr, for winning regional Edward R. Murrow Awards this week. The station has won 26 Murrow Awards since 2007, far and above any broadcast outlet in Wyoming history. Please support this high-quality news with your pledge today. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.